Think back to your time in high school. Did you ever feel that you were in a prison? Did you ever feel that you were in a machine that had its own purposes and goals and had no relation to what you actually wanted to do or achieve? If you did, then you shouldn't be surprised, because this reflects the nature of what the modern school is. The modern school was invented by the Prussians after 1806. Before then, education was delivered in many different ways. What we think of as the school was invented in that particular time and place. And it was invented for a very particular purpose, which was to produce loyal, obedient subjects and soldiers, and people who would also be productive and obedient workers. It's this that explains why school is the way it is and has the features that it has. It explains why it is that the school day is divided up into rigid, time-structured blocks. It explains why it is that the organisation of the school is hierarchical and highly structured. It explains why it is that people are taught with people of their own age instead of people who are at the same stage of interest or ability as themselves. And it explains why in many school systems, one of the functions of the system is to direct people into particular life paths, to sort out young people into different kind of career groups. To the extent that education actually does take place in schools, it's a happy accident or a byproduct. Now, there are many people who work in schools who believe that education, in fact, is the main point of what they're doing, and who are trying very hard to educate the people in their charge. However, the problem is that the whole system they're working in, the way it's set up and the way it is organised, is hostile to that golden endeavour, so that they're in the unfortunate position of constantly trying to push water uphill, if you will, and any success they have is gained against the odds. What we need to realise is that education and schooling are not the same thing. In fact, because we think that schooling is the same thing as education, we have a radically impoverished idea of what education is and could be. Why, for example, do we assume that education should only take place at one stage of a person's life? Education is something that can take place at any stage in someone's life, and indeed should do. Why assume that we have to educate people the same age altogether? Surely this is a crazy way of doing it. Why do we have to deliver education in the highly structured and formalised way that schools require us to do it in? Education is something which should be central to most people's lives. What we need to do is to get away from the idea that schools are the only way in which we can deliver education.
The views and opinions expressed on the following show are those of raving lunatics and do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or its advertisers. Nothing you hear should be construed as legal or medical advice.
I've got one that can see.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room, you can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Power don't come from a badge or a gun. Power comes from a lie. Lying big and getting the whole damn world to play along with you. Once you got everybody agreeing with what they know in their hearts, ain't sure you've got them by the balls.
There are no sides. There's no Sunnis and Shiites. There's no Democrats or Republicans. There's only haves and have-nots.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah. That's why you're the judge and I'm the law-talking guy.
The lawyer.
Right.
If there's one thing America needs, it's more lawyers. Can you imagine a world without lawyers?
Oh. Listen, sucker. I'm more militant than you and your whole damn army put together. While you out there chanting at rallies and browbeating politicians, I'm taking out any money front sucker on a Hummel that gets in my way. So I tell you what. When your so-called revolution starts, you call me. And I'll be right down front showing you how it's done. But until then, you need to shut the f*** up when grown folks is talking.
You are listening to Live Free FM.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, sentient creations of all shapes, colors, and sizes, welcome to the show. This is Live Free FM. I'm your host, Nathan Frazier, and you're tuned in for two pure 2 hours of pure audio anarchy. Tonight is the triumphant return of Live Free FM. I was not able to do the show last week because I had to get some outside of the show work done. So I did take the week off, but tonight we're going to have probably one of the most thought-provoking episodes of the show that we've ever had. We're joined tonight by, I don't even know where to start. We're joined by Jan Irvin from Gnostic Media. Jan, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. So I guess just to start off the show, actually, you know what? Before we jump into it, I'm going to give a real quick shout out to everybody that's in the chat room early. It looks like Ollie Lara is there. Ban Jovi is there. Hectician Ra is there. Hieroglyphical is there. Home Gym is there. Jules is there. What's up, Jules? Much love to you. Mike SLC, Modern Man, Philip Raquel, Souvenir, I think. Maybe I'm mispronouncing that, and if so, I apologize. Super Sam is there. What's up, Super Sam? I hope you got that package I sent to you. Myself, Sovereign King, if you want to talk to me, but I sometimes don't answer because I have problems trying to do two things at once. Vegan Lady is there. Vincent Easley is there. Likes Good R is there. Rads is there. Listener is there. King for Mayor and a bunch of anonymous listeners. Everybody that tuned in early and supports the show, much love and thank you very much. Also, I want to give a shout out to UCY.TV, who carries the show. That's Jules' network. You guys can go over there and check out a huge amount of awesome, as Jan would say, unprogramming. And also you can go over to Truth Frequency Radio, check out all their shows, and you can go to my website, livefreefm.com, and check out all the archives. Well, a good amount of the archives. I'm still trying to get the entire library loaded back up after last year's hack, but I am working diligently at that. So, tonight is Sunday, the 20th of October, and we've got somebody who has probably been one of the most influential people on the way that I do my show and on the way that I research in general, and that's Jan Irvin of Gnostic Media, the Gnostic Media podcast over at GnosticMedia.com. I guess just for a quick introduction, I'll let you do your own introduction, Jan, but kind of let people know who you are and what it is that you do over at Gnostic Media.
Well, let's see. That's a big question. I run the Gnostic Media podcast. As you said, I'm a writer, researcher. I've published a couple of books. I've done an hour ago released my 180th episode for the Gnostic Media podcast. I'm the publisher for John Allegro's infamous book, or famous book, depending on how you want to look at it, known as The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And I'm an ethnomycologist. I've also revealed concurrent CIA MKUltra-related programs that are still going on today and didn't end after the 1970s Church Commission. And I run the TriviumEducation.com website, and we're just about to re-release Pop-Up Fallacies and some other good stuff like that. So there's a nutshell, I suppose.
All right. And for the listeners, the reason why I wanted to have you on, Jan, and I've actually wanted to have you on for a while. We touched base about a year ago, and then on my end, things just kind of fell apart. But luckily, we were able to reschedule it for tonight. But basically, the purpose of Live Free FM is a show that's dedicated to helping people live free. And one of the things that prevents people from living free is when their ability to rationalize, their ability to cognize things is hampered. And it seems like the way that the world works, there's two different things to employ on trying to free yourself or empower yourself. And that's using knowledge to obviously advance yourself. But we also see the tactic of using that knowledge and suppressing it from other people to disempower them. And one of the things that your show and a lot of guys that are kind of in the same realm of media that you do is seems like you guys are dedicated to bringing forth this knowledge that has been occulted for millennia. And it seems like you guys are dedicated to bringing this forth to help the listeners or the studiers out there to empower themselves to kind of even the playing field as it may be. So I think that for in my own life, the things that I've learned through your show have been an incredible tool, actually an entire set of tools to pursue my own autodidactic learning. And I just kind of wanted to start off the interview with, I guess, asking what it is that motivates that, what it is that that drives the type of media that you do.
Well, that's a really good question. I suppose early on when I started out, I was one of the key people working with Jack Hare and the California Hemp Initiative early on, and he turned me on to various areas of research that I verified and knew were correct. And, you know, I suppose the other aspect that is more current, you know, since the early 90s, you know, and this happened about 4 years ago, is this quote here that I received from Gino Denning, and it says, "For if you the rulers suffer your people to be ill-educated, and their manners to be corrupted from their infancy, and then punish them for those crimes to which their first education disposed them, what else could be concluded from this but that you first make thieves and outlaws, and then punish them?" And that's from Sir Thomas More, Utopia, Book 1, and that is from the early 16th century, about probably the 1520s, 1530s. And so this is really, you know, what it comes down to is, you know, it's one thing to, you know, for people to be down on their own, and then you sit there and say, oh, well, you know, they caused it. But when you sit there and you cause the problems and you cause the ignorance and you basically you step on someone's face while you're giving them a hand up, that sort of thing, you know, that sort of illogical, incongruous behavior just doesn't, you know, it doesn't sit well with me. And thanks to Gino Denning, 4 years ago on my show next week, it is 4 years ago next week, he came on and he introduced me to the Trivium and the Quadrivium. And that really sort of changed the game in how things work and how we can see things. The true Trivium and how Gino Denning presented it, otherwise known as the Trivium method, is essentially like, you know, it'd be like taking the red pill in the Matrix films. I mean, suddenly you can see all of the BS. You can see how it works. You can see how the government and the politicians and the mainstream media and marketing and public relations, how they misuse this information to manipulate all of us using fallacies and getting us to appeal to false authority, getting us to not trust our own five senses and the like. And so this has all really caused a, especially since the early 1900s and the time of Edward Bernays and his ilk, it's really caused a downturn in the whole of society. And when we get in and we see the true seven liberating arts and how it reveals, there's basically two forms of the Trivium. There's like the classical Trivium, which is what guys like Marshall McLuhan, who were in marketing, used to manipulate and control everybody. And then there's the Trivium method, which is sort of its inverse, and it reveals how they do all of that manipulation. You know, one of the ways, if you want to manipulate people, would be to get them to put their conclusions before doing any research. So under the Trivium is essentially grammar, logic, and rhetoric, or it's who, what, where, when, why, and how. Or if we break it down another way, grammar could be considered input, which is who, what, where, and when, and then logic can be could be considered processing, which would be why, and then rhetoric would be considered output, which would be how. And so when we break it down like this, we can see, you know, if you think of your computer, if you try to put processing before input, what would happen? You get the old adage, garbage in, garbage out. You know, you basically, you're only processing what you channel from your anus or the Pleiades, you know? And so once we realize that we have to put who, what, where, and when before we can ever determine why something is or what the or how it is, you know, before we can ever reach those two steps, we have to know who, what, where, and when. And so, I mean, how, why? If you just think for a second, why what? You know, so right away, if you ask why first, then you go, well, why what? But here's the thing is, people in our society are left to answer why something is without gathering any data, and then they just leap to the first conclusion that comes to them, or that they heard from somebody else, or that somebody else told them, without ever checking any of the data. So essentially what this is all about, to make a long story longer, is to empower people so that they can see how these systems work. And, you know, the only way that this stuff can be used against anyone is if you don't know about it.
Right. And I think that through the education system and then continued on through the media as adults, we're taught to just accept the whys without first processing the how and first inputting the who, what, when, and where.
Right. Well, you know, that's the whole idea through the compulsory education system, is to teach you to essentially to always appeal to authority. The first one that you're taught to appeal to is the teacher. Later on, it's the professor, you know, and then the judge and the president and the saluting the, you know, the state conditioning, where you repeat, you know, mantras every day when you get to school in the morning, and you swear to this flag, taking your allegiance to it, you know, and you know, and all of this sort of stuff. This is all conditioning that all goes along with that. But when you understand the trivium essentially, it makes us all sovereigns, and it gets us to think critically about things. And rather than accepting someone's authority or what someone tells us, we go out and we gather first all of the knowledge, you know. And when we, you know, for instance, if you're building a car engine, you want to know all of the parts of the car engine and how they go together, et cetera, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't just, you know, so let's say if you were to take the car engine and lay all the parts all over the driveway and you put a name next to each one, okay? This would be the grammar stage. This is your knowledge stage of the trivium, or the who, what, where, and when. And so you've laid all of these parts out. You could even say, you know, this was invented by this person in this year, and then you would actually gain more knowledge about that part and what it does. But all of those parts all over the driveway, they're all nouns. Every one of them is a noun, including the driveway. But now you have all of these parts, and now you have them named, you know what they are, and you have a clear knowledge of every noun on that driveway. And so then the next step is to remove the contradictions. And, you know, that whole process of removing the contradictions would be the processing of logic. And the processing of logic, once you have all of those contradictions removed, is that engine is put together. And it works. Okay? And then the final step, the rhetoric aspect, or the how, the end stage of that, would be, let's say, you writing an engine manual of how to take apart and put back together that engine, and being able to explain it clearly and perfectly to anybody downstream from you, so that they're, you know, totally clear and coherent on that message. So the manual is the rhetoric aspect, right? So you have the nouns laid all over the driveway. You put them together. You have the engine that's working, and that's the logic aspect. The final stage is the manual.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just have to say that anybody that's listening, I would recommend going to Gnostic Media and, if possible, checking out the Gino Denning interviews that you did. Because when I was listening to them, the entire time I was just having little lights go off and connections made in my brain of all these things that I had these gut feelings about, but I had no way to explain not only to myself but to other people. And after listening to that series, all of a sudden I was able to make those connections. I was able to fill in the blanks and then be able to go and explain these problems with reality that I was seeing that other people seemed completely oblivious to. But by having the grammar and the logic first and then trying to output the rhetoric, by having those steps in that order,
sure,
putting my rhetoric out was that much more convincing, and people were able to understand it that much more.
And let me just say this, you know, the compulsory education system and the like, you know, the reason why people can't agree on a topic is essentially this: they don't get on the same page first. So let's say you have all of these engine parts laid out all over the driveway, right, and they're all named. And you can see each one clearly and coherently. And then somebody, they come along and they want to tell you about how your car engine and everything is wrong that you've done on your driveway, but they refuse to ever go and look at it. Okay. And essentially what they do is they come over and they tell you, you know, well, all of those parts for your barbecue all over your driveway, I mean, it's clear you don't even know how to put together a barbecue. Are you stupid? And I mean, this is literally what they do all of the time. So the reason why, and this is, you know, where things like quantum physics comes in and the like, because these people, you know, we'll say, oh, well, you know, everything, you know, reality is subjective. Everything is subjective or relative. And the reason why that is because they actually refuse to sit down. I mean, if you're sitting there and reading, you know, page 221 of XYZ book, and you're telling the person, you know, sitting next to you what it says, and they're like, F you, dude. No, it doesn't. I don't believe you, man. That's you're retarded. You're a conspiracy theorist. And you're like, dude, it's right here, and here's the citations. And they refuse to look at it, and they're telling you what it says and how you could be wrong without just turning their head and looking at it and looking up the citations, right? So if they turn their head, then they can say, okay, well, you know, here's what it says, and say, well, what does this word mean to you? And then, you know, you can both agree on each of the definitions of the words. And so once you have the definitions of the words and you understand what it says, then you can say, okay, well, where did they get this information? And you can verify the citations. If it's saying that person, you know, John made a specific statement on Sunday the 21st of 1970, you can go and you can look that up, and did he say that? And if the citation is correct, then you can say, oh, well, that is true. It is a fact, period. You know, so what happens, though, is people have been essentially taught to not trust their own five senses. They believe that truth doesn't exist, that 1 + 1 isn't 2, that, you know, Amit Goswami, who goes around like on the JRE show saying that, you know, that quantum physics, it's like magic, it can't be proved, it's voodoo, it's all of this stuff. You know, the reason why nobody can agree with quantum physics, the reason why no quantum physicists understand it, is because they're debating the contradictions and the fallacies in their own minds from, number one, not verifying the premises of their beliefs in the first place, and number two, not getting on the same page, and number three, not removing all of the contradictions. So what happens is you get a 90-plus-year debate of these guys pontificating over the fallacies in their own heads, rather than, you know, when you realize that out in nature, when you look out in nature, there are no contradictions in nature. You know, it's essentially, you know, when you see a contradiction in nature, that would be it would be like a car accident, two nouns trying to occupy the same place at the same time. It can't happen. And so what happens is you have an accident. But, you know, people will not understand that there are no contradictions in nature, and then they see all the contradictions in their own mind, and you can't know truth and all of this stuff, rather than realizing it's their own failure to look things up, it's their own failure to realize that every time they see a contradiction, it's either an error or a lie. And so the reason why they can't figure it out is they need to step back and gather in more data. Whenever you see a contradiction, if you can't figure out which one it is, you have to step back and ask who, what, where, and when again, and bring in more data. You always go back down to grammar and gather in more of the nouns and make sure that all of your information down on the grammar level is correct. You check out all of the verbs and the adjectives. You make sure that everything checks out. And then you move forward again, and you have a systematic process that you've gone through this information. You know, so this is why it's so important for the compulsory education system to essentially get people to appeal to authority or to just leap to a false conclusion first. And then what happens is, because they don't know how to ask who, what, where, and when before they take in data, it destroys their self-esteem. And then over years, they don't really trust themselves. They'll go out and they'll attack anyone who really has any systematic method of verifying information and things like that, because they really feel insecure. So life becomes, you know, a religion. It becomes a, you know, basically they live in this world where, to them, reality is like Roger Rabbit land. It's the quantum physics insane asylum, you know. So anyway, so, you know, that's where, to me, that's how all of this stuff breaks down. You know, and for your audience who wants to find out more on quantum physics, I recommend checking out Peace Revolution, episode number 62 from Richard Grove's show. That's David Harriman's full six-hour lecture, The Philosophic Corruption of Physics. And then I've also interviewed him a couple of times on my show.
Well, and just to add my own two cents in, by learning the Trivium method, not really the Trivium education, but the actual Trivium method that Gino Denning and you, and there are other people out there that have taken what you started and kind of expanded upon it, but by utilizing it in my own court cases, in my own studies of the legal system, I found that it makes understanding what's going on in a legal proceeding that much easier as well. It makes it to where, just like you explained, you start with making sure that you're both on the same map. So you start off by defining the terms, by defining the words that you're going to be using, and making sure that you guys are both speaking the same language. And then from there, it's a matter of weeding out the inconsistencies or the lies. And
sure,
by doing that, you basically back the prosecutor or the judge into a corner where they either have to show their hand that they're basically trying to commit fraud against you, or they have to try and stack more lies on top of it. And when you're armed with the knowledge that the ability to disseminate the BS that the Trivium method allows you to have, it makes it almost impossible for them to pull one over on you. And that's, the court system is great for using lawyer talk to basically get people confused and put them in a position where they feel helpless. But when sure. when using the Trivium method, I think that that I've found, by using the stuff that I've learned from you and combining it with the stuff that I learned from Mark Stevens, every single time that I've gone into court, I've been able to back up judges and lawyers into corners, basically, where they had no way out, and it was just by defining the terms and eliminating the inconsistencies. We're coming up on a commercial break. When we come back, one of the listeners wanted to know what your opinions on the Common Core education system is, so we'll probably talk about that a little bit. We'll get into my favorite part of learning the trivia, and the thing that stuck with me, which was the logical fallacies, and we'll apply some of the logical fallacies to the belief in the state. So when we come back, more with Jan Irving, more very deep, thought-provoking conversation. Don't go anywhere, because tonight's show is guaranteed to be one that you're going to kick yourself in the butt if you miss. So we'll be right back on the other side of these commercial break, or the other side of this commercial break. This is Live Free FM. Don't go anywhere.
Because I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. of thousands of years, one question has plagued the greatest minds of our species. How can mankind best be governed? Now, after all this time, a new question has arisen. How can mankind best be free? Live Free FM, it's like a roadmap to a stateless society.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to the show. This is Live Free FM, and we're joined tonight by Jan Irving of the Gnostic Media Podcast. Real quick, before we jump back into it, I got to give a big shout out to Jax Rocks, who joined us in the chat room, and to Reverend F. Nelia, and or Nyla. I don't know how to pronounce your last name, Nick, and also Mike McPuff, who joined us as well. Much love, both of you guys, and thank you for joining us. And before we went into the break, Jan, somebody mentioned in the chat room this new phenomenon called the Common Core education. Can you tell us what you know about that?
Sure. Well, it's actually not new. It's just people are waking up and checking citation again. What is this? And looking it up and going, oh, this is really bad. Common Core is essentially a company out of India that the U.S. government and other groups of, you know, political and financial groups have set up in India as sort of a front company, and then they bid their own stuff back into the U.S. and elsewhere, and they're really using it as a global education system, and one of the key people behind it is Bill Gates, you know, so that'll tell you. But it's essentially to make all of the education around the world identical so that you have a bunch of drone people with the same education everywhere, acting and thinking the same way, doing the same sorts of things for the globalist elite. And, you know, I wish I were kidding. And for those of you who are saying, oh, that's a wacky conspiracy theorist, you know, rather than name calling, like we were talking about earlier, look up the information, and just recently, and it's on the front page of my website, GnosticMedia.com, is my recent episode with Clint Richardson. So I do recommend everybody check that out, and we actually do go into the financial information and financial documents on Common Core education, and that is Gnostic Media episode number 173.
All right, and I wanted to kind of move from there into, I guess we were talking about Gino Denning, and we were talking about the Trivium, and I mentioned my favorite part, what I got the most out of as an introductory, an introduction into the Trivium method, was the series of logical fallacies. That's what really clicked with me right away. And one that you did a series with Larkin Rose, and Larkin Rose has actually been on this show quite a few times, and when I finally heard him on your show, I was so excited. I was like, yes, because obviously your audience is much bigger than mine, and I thought that your audience would love the stuff that Larkin brought up. And you guys did an entire, like, three-part series on the Advaricundium, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, basically the appeal to authority, or the appeal to false authority. And
sure,
it was an awesome, like, it was probably one of the most in-depth inspections of this false authority that people are so blind to. I kind of wanted to go from there and kind of touch on some of the other fallacies that reinforce that blind faith in false authority that is the state. So for this segment of the show, at least, I kind of wanted to get into some of the other fallacies that I think deserve to have a little bit of the spotlight shined on them. And maybe we can go through, and first of all, I guess, explain what it is that a logical fallacy is.
Well, the word fallacy comes from the Latin, essentially fallare, to deceive or to lie. And there are two forms of logical fallacies. There's informal and formal fallacies. Formal fallacies are based strictly on the logical formation of an argument, such as deductive, and informal fallacies are the most commonly recognized and easiest to learn and take into account non-logical content of an argument, and they are inductive and are typically false for epistemological, dialectical, or pragmatic reasons. So fallacies of the informal type typically fall under relevance, presumption, and ambiguity. And so, there's a number of fallacies. There's no limit to the number of lies that people make up. There are probably close to 200 documented logical fallacies. When somebody says, no real Christian or no real Scotsman would ever do something like that, that's known as the no true Scotsman fallacy. When we appeal to novelty and things new, Terence McKenna was famous for this fallacy. That is the fallacy of appealing to novelty. There is the spotlight fallacy, appeal to emotion. False alternative fallacies. There's the middle of the road fallacy, which is one of the politicians' favorites. Let's say you have the facts and truth on one side, and you know what they are, and you verified it, and somebody comes up with a total lie on the other side, right? And then the politician comes along, now, let's just settle things down. We can come to an agreement between both sides, can't we? Let's settle right here in the middle. Well, see, the middle of a lie and truth is still a lie.
So it would be kind of like if you were saying 2 plus 2 equals 4, and somebody else said, no, 2 plus 2 equals 6, and a politician comes in and says, let's just agree that 2 plus 2 equals 5, because that is right in the middle.
Right, exactly. And so everybody is going to believe and go along with the lie because it's just the middle of the road. It doesn't matter if there's a truth there, right? And so we have the neglected aspect fallacy, like somebody, they don't take full stack of all of the information on something, such as the elephant in the room, right? Another common fallacy that people like to use is a guilt by association. Now, so-and-so, and therefore they're dirty also because you were CIA. And this is, what people who often use on me who refuse to look at my research, they'll say, well, Jan Ervin, all of his research is guilt by association. Never mind that I've gone through all these libraries and pulled up these people's primary documents and things like that, where they admit it, they won't look at any of that. And then they'll just say, oh, well, he uses the guilt by association. But, what people have to realize is there's another fallacy that you have to recognize in studying fallacies, because just because you see a fallacy doesn't mean something isn't true. So there's a such thing as the fallacious fallacy, and this is because I spot a fallacy, I'm going to assume that you're lying. So let's say you live in a village on one side of a hill, and there's a village on the other side of a hill, and there is the town idiot that lives up on the top of the hill. And he comes screaming down, using all sorts of fallacies. These idiots from the other side, they've got an army. They're coming to kill us all, appeal to fear and all of this kind of stuff, right? And so you could either, that guy, he's an idiot. We've seen him play cry wolf in the past. Or you could just verify personally through your own five senses if what he's saying is correct. Just do a little who, what, where, and when. You stick your head up over the hill and you look and you go, oh, crap, there's an army coming. So you can, these sorts of things we can always go out and verify. But just because we see a fallacy, it should trigger us to actually do that extra step to make sure that it's actually accurate. We always should, really. But, when you see the fallacies, it really helps you to cut through the BS twice as quick and to just verify things when you do spot those fallacies.
So you brought up the fallacy of guilt by association, and I know of another fallacy, and I don't know the name of it, but it's kind of the opposite of guilt by association. question, where instead of saying, I don't like you because you're associated to something I don't like, it's where people tie themselves to something that they know people do like beer tying itself to sex, or M&Ms using the circle in between the M and the M to spell out mom, and they assume people love their mom, so people subconsciously love the package of M&Ms. Or politicians, when they wrap themselves in the flag, well, people love the American flag. If I wrap myself in it, people will love me as well. What is that fallacy called?
Well, you named a couple of different ones there, but, you know, one of them is sort of a version of the ad hominem where, you know, you're saying, well, I don't like you, or you're not associated with this group, or you don't believe this thing, so therefore I'm going to dismiss, you know, everything about you. That would be an ad hominem. Or if you say, well, you know, you wrote something where you were wrong in 1994, so therefore everything you've ever said in your life is wrong. This is known as poisoning the well. You know, you always take somebody's work on a case-by-case, point-by-point basis. You know, just because somebody got work wrong in an article that they wrote last week doesn't mean that the new article that they're writing this week is going to have errors. You have to go case-by-case, point-by-point, in each individual citation on its own merit. You know, and a lot of people will say, wow, well, you know, well, that would just take so much time if I, you know, verified all of this stuff. I would just spend my whole life verifying everything. Well, the antithesis of that, and it, you know, and it often, especially in the internet age, it often takes a few seconds or minutes, sometimes hours, days. I mean, you know, and I've written books on certain subjects that have taken me maybe 6 months or a year or more to flush out. But, you know, you can spend that time flushing something out, and then you can go out and write a book on it, or have all of these things that you can do with that information, or you can follow a lie for your whole life.
Right. And that's,
you know, and most people will actually choose the lie.
Hopefully not most people in our collective listening audience, though.
Oh, well, you know, probably, but so, you know, you know, see, most people don't realize that unless you put grammar first and then check things and then remove, you know, there's two stages of spotting those logical fallacies. There's the stage of the fallacy of the information coming in via the five senses and us reviewing it. And, you know, as we're learning the trivium, you know, we kind of stumble through it. You know, first we have to memorize the fallacies, and then, you know, we kind of stumble through it. And then around the 2-year mark, it suddenly becomes sort of automatic, and then you don't really notice it anymore. It's just, woo, you know, kind of going through your head. And so, you know, there's a period where people go through this sort of stumbling and tripping and things like that, but you just need to stick with it. And then, you know, eventually you pick up and you run with it. But eventually you get to a point where people really can't lie to you.
Yeah, and one of the examples of that that I thought was really awesome, and I know that you're actually bringing this back, was you used to do like pop-up fallacy videos where you would take a speech from Obama and you would just pop up every single fallacy, and it was rampant. It was like almost like a 7-to-1 lie to truth ratio.
Well, I think, you know, and we came up with the term LPM, and that's lies per minute. And, you know, and actually you're kind of letting the cat out of the bag a little bit maybe, but I might as well say it on your show. But we've actually just completely revamped the popupfallacies.com website, and we're getting ready to, in fact, I'm looking at it right now, but we're getting ready to relaunch the pop-up fallacies and hopefully get some ground with it. You know, I just kind of lost traction early on, and I had too many things going on, but I only put out 2 videos of it ever, and there's been a huge demand for it. I mean, people bring it up to me constantly. You really need to do that. You really need to do that. So we're finally putting out, we're going to put out some new episodes. The website is totally redone. We've got everything redone. New intro songs, new pop-ups, new everything for the whole project.
And we've mentioned rhetoric, and rhetoric kind of gets a bad name because when people hear the term rhetoric, they often think of the rhetorical speech of politicians. How often are these pop-up, well, not pop-up, but how often are these fallacious arguments and logical fallacies used by the politicians, whether they're trying to convince us or sway us or even in debates against each other? Is it a pretty common tactic that they use?
It's actually the main tactic that they use. And, you know, for instance, about a month ago, I interviewed General Albert Stubblebine on my show, and I asked him about the trivium and all of this, and he just said, well, yeah, I mean, that's part of the game. Just he admitted it straight up that they in fact, use the trivium for all of this stuff. But the politicians, let me just take a step back for a second. Let's go to commercial television, then we'll come back to the politicians. Let's say your average 30-second TV commercial. In 30 seconds, they usually manage to run 20 to 40 of the core fallacies.
In 30 seconds?
In 30 seconds.
That's amazing.
20 to 40 of the core fallacies. You know, like appeal to emotion, you'll see a shampoo commercial. You know, he'll be, his hair is turning gray, right? And he's walking down the street and he sees this hot chick and he's like, you know, going home and he's going to be alone tonight. So there's an appeal to emotion. You know, he's, you know, they're appealing essentially to him not getting laid that night, right? And, you know, so they start, you know, using all of these different, you know, and that specific commercial is more just an appeal to emotion. But others will get into more of using a whole bunch of them, you know, sort of all at once. You know, appeal to popularity is a common one that television commercials use. But, yeah, I mean, your politician typically, you know, is somebody who, oh, geez, well, I mean, I know very few that aren't adept at utilizing huge numbers of fallacies. Another very common fallacy the politicians like to use, you know, ad hominem. You know, like Obama is calling everybody now a political terrorist who doesn't buy his rhetoric against the Republicans for not trying to, get his socialist, medical scam through, where, you know, we're actually going to end up worse off than before. And not only that, but he has no jurisdiction. I mean, you know, the Washington, D.C. has a 10-mile jurisdiction around Washington, D.C., and none, no other than that, except by consent. So you know what? As far as Obama and those, clowns and their appeal to false authority are concerned, they can keep it within their 10-mile jurisdiction. It only applies to their own employees and not to any of us. And so they trick us into thinking that we're employees of the federal government, and this is how they do this stuff. But you know, well, so he is actually going around calling everybody a political terrorist, which is an ad hominem attack. It is a false attack. And, you know, what they've done is they've tried to get, train people to react to terrorism as an emotional cue word. When if you look in a good dictionary, it says right there that terrorism is used by governments to drive the people towards a political goal. And so, you know, used by governments, folks, that is what terrorism is.
And if it, originally, the definition of terrorism was the not just government using terrorism or terror against a off in the distance population. Originally, terrorism meant a government that uses terror to control their own population.
That's exactly right. That's what I'm getting at. And, you know, in fact, on a recent episode, Clint Richardson pulled up all of the information. It's Clint Richardson, and it's under Hot Topics on the Gnostic Media website, a public notice to the NSA and all U.S. intelligence spy agencies and their agents. And we go into terrorism and, you know, how they use all of this information. They use essentially the color of law to be able to do all of their illegal stuff. But, you know, they're all violating U.S. Code Title 18, Subsection 242. Whoever under the color of any law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom willfully subjects any person in any state, territory, commonwealth, possession, jurisdiction or district to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured or protected by the Constitution or the laws of the United States shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 1 year or both, and if bodily injury results from the acts committed in violation of this section, or if such acts include the use, attempted use, or threatened use of a dangerous weapon, explosives, or fire, shall be under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years or both, and if death results from the acts committed in violation of this section, or if such acts include kidnapping or an attempt to kidnap, aggravated sexual abuse, or an attempt to commit aggravated sexual abuse, or an attempt to kill, so shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for any term of years or for life or both, or may be sentenced to death. And so all of you intelligence agents out there listening to this episode, I've just put you all on notice.
See, the only thing that sucks, though, is the people that we would have to turn to get remedy for the situation are the exact same people breaking that law in the
first place. Oh, no. What, you know, see, the color of law, see, what you have to realize is that this takes away the umbrella of government that they hide under to commit these acts of violence. And so what you do is you go after them as individual men and women. You know, you forget this umbrella that they go, you know, that they all hide under. You know, they put on clown costumes and Halloween costumes and then go commit behavior that they would, you know, under the name of government that they would never otherwise commit. So under U.S. Code Title 18, Subsection 242, we are removing the deprivation of rights under the color of law. So I've just stripped them of that excuse. So now each and every agent is solely responsible for their own actions.
So how is it, and this is one of the things that I often have to question myself, and you hit the nail on the head, is these are just people. They're individual people, but they're able to commit these atrocities against other human beings because they have this, like Larkin False. Rose.
Sure, the false ad verecundium fallacy, or the false appeal to authority. You know, it's. Let me put it like this. Let me just interrupt you real quick. You know, it's like when you see on Hollywood, you know, these stars and stuff, and everybody gets all excited about the stars. Or if you see a judge up on a bench, or if you see a policeman, you know, there's something in all that all of these people have in common. They all use a certain trick that is really the false, sort of a, almost an inverse of the ad verecundium, but it's peacocking. Okay, you know, the policeman puts on a bulletproof vest and a shiny badge and a mustache and a, you know, big donut belly. You know, a judge sits three steps up and he puts on a black robe. The star, you know, they have people all around him. So this is all calls back to essentially our primate alpha beta nature, and they play this against us. And so the, you know, one of the key tricks that the alphas like to use against the betas is peacocking, is just false puffing up and getting people to buy into the verecundium, right? And so, you know, it's like you can look at all of these different cultures. You know, people always like to bash on the Germans and Hitler. I'm getting pretty sick of that example. I think another good example would be, you know, Israel and the Palestinians or something like that. But, you know, what we have to do is always dehumanize the other group. And then, you know, there's a whole process that's gone through logically, that where we, you know, just simply dehumanize, attack, go after the other side, and then we can justify this dehumanizing behavior against the others using all of these logical fallacies, et cetera, that they use. And then they'll say, oh, you know, well, we're the authority because, you know, peacock, we say so.
Yeah, so is this, when we talk about politicians constantly using these type of things in their arguments, and we talk about people that are the quote-unquote elite of society using these subliminal attacks against us, are these things that they are consciously doing? Do they learn these things and learn how to employ them? Or is it just something, because I know myself, once I started learning the logical fallacies, I started catching myself using them, and I started saying, hey, for the longest time, I've used these fallacies, and it's no longer right. Okay for me to use them, and I had to start checking myself. But right. Do these people, are they consciously taught to use these against us?
Well, you know, I think there's a couple of different stages. I think, you know, there's probably a management class that they put in over us, right? And then I think that the ones at the top are just ruthless. You know, there may be ethics issues or whatever. They don't understand natural law. They think that whatever is, you know, whatever victory at whatever cost is okay. And, you know, that's a good question. We do know that there are aspects of the classical trivium taught in the Ivy League schools. Is it taught to the extent that, you know, it definitely seems like the elite love to get caught up in a lot of their own BS. And, you know, so who knows? I mean, a lot of it is clearly irrational behavior, but they certainly do use these tools on us. But if it's the classical form of it, it usually has a lot of, you know, appeal to the smell of their own farts wrapped with it.
that's an awesome explanation of it. We're coming up on a break pretty soon. Before we go into the break, though, let people know where they can check out more of your stuff and some stuff that you would recommend that maybe not be your own work, but some stuff that you think people should also look at.
All right. Well, let's see. They can check out my website, GnosticMedia.com. That's GnosticMedia.com. They can also check out TriviumEducation.com, TriviumEducation.com. And I also recommend people check out TragedyAndHope.com and also check out School Sucks Podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I have so much more. We've got another hour of the show, and I have so many more questions. Would you be able to stick around for the second hour of the show?
I can do at least another 35 minutes or so, maybe 40 minutes.
All right, awesome. Okay, we'll come back on the other side of the show. I kind of want to get into the Prussian education system and then the control of the counterculture. Obviously, we've got absolute control over the mainstream culture, and I kind of want to delve into the possibility of controlling the countercultures or the idea of controlled opposition. So don't go anywhere, everybody. We've got more with Jan Irving and myself. This is Live Free FM. We'll be right back on the other side of the break. Don't go anywhere.
Still clinging to the myth of government?
That's so last millennium.
Still waiting for some great man to come and save you?
You're such a square, man.
Still clinging to blind faith in authority figures?
Really? I mean, really?
Well, if so, then Live Free FM is not the show for you.
Live Free FM! Faith in each other, not in authority! Live Free FM!
To us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
The problem in the past has been the man turning us against one another. We have been unable to see the truth because we have been fighting for 10 square feet of ground. Our turf. Our little piece of
Crash, brothers! Since they're just things, I don't suppose you mind letting us take a quick look-see inside your bag.
Oh, I very much mind, Annie. There's no such thing as a quick invasion of civil liberty.
Oh, it all starts with a quick look-see into someone's bag, and then it's a brisk peek-a-rooney at our phone records, and before you can say 1984, the thought police are forcing you to bend and spread.
Bend and spread? Are the thought police gonna make love to us?
Welcome to the gross business of martial law. Welcome to what used to be individuality, seized and disintegrated by cowardly groupthink. Welcome, my friends. Welcome to the machine. Machine.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us.
You are listening to Live Free FM.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to the second hour of the show. This is Live Free FM. We're broadcasting live on the Truth Frequency Radio Network and on UCY.TV. Unless you're listening to a podcast, which you can download more over at livefreefm.com. Real quick, before we jump back into the show, I want to give a shout out to B3, who just joined us in the classroom or in the chat room. My bad, Rowdy Roddy Piper and Raze, who just joined us as well. Much love to everybody that's in the chat room. If you want to join the chat room and get yourself shouted out and made famous through my radio show as well, you can always go to livefreefm.com and click on the listen and chat page and. Make sure you do it on Sunday nights, though, because that's when we're actually on. If you do it on any other time of the week, I won't be able to shout you out because I will not see you. Jan, we're back, and you said that you'd graciously bestow upon us another half hour of your time, and I really do appreciate that. I can't even tell you how excited I am about the show tonight because I've been wanting to get you on for so long. Like I said, you've been one of my like huge inspirations influences on the way that I approach researching and on the way that I approach my rhetoric. And that's what this show is my attempt at rhetoric, I guess. Before we left, though, we were talking about some of the logical fallacies and the possibility of these people knowing or maybe not just completely subconsciously using these methods against us. I know that within Masonry, they teach the fallacy, not specifically the fallacies, but they do teach some of the trivium methods, or they at least sure. teach a part of it. And also in some Catholic schools, I've learned that they teach the trivium as well. What's your opinion about that?
Well, a lot of them will actually, you know, if you look up the trivium and a lot of the Masonic teachings, they'll actually teach it like grammar, rhetoric, logic, etc. One of the key ways to keep people under your control is to teach the trivium out of order, because just like I explained earlier, you can't know why something is. If I ask you why, you say, why what? You know, that's kind of the automatic response that people have. It's because why can't come before what? What always comes before why? So, you know, how, what? You know, see what I mean? You know, you always have to go back to what, and then you can go who, what, where, when, or you can say, well, not a what, it was a who, you know, this sort of thing. And then where was it and when was it? Now you have something you can go, oh, well, why were they there, or how did that happen? You know, and then you can sort of build from it. But if you understand that any time you take this stuff out of order, it cripples the victim. Now, with the higher level of the seven liberating arts, which is the quadrivium, it's arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. So now a lot of middle schools today will teach arithmetic and then algebra and then geometry and then on down the line. Well, algebra came historically out of geometry. So if you teach it before geometry, you're actually crippling the student, just as you are by getting them to appeal to authority by putting logic before grammar. But the reason why it's arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy is and this is the full seven liberating arts, is grammar, logic, rhetoric, arithmetic, geometry, music, astronomy, always in that order. Arithmetic is number in itself. Geometry is number in space. Music or harmonic theory is number in time. And then astronomy is number in space and time. So, you know, just like who, what, where, and when go before why and how, arithmetic goes before geometry, goes before music, goes before astronomy. They all build so that you have a full encompassing knowledge, and then you have a systematic method. I mean, obviously, the numbers of arithmetic, when we get into the world around us with grammar, logic, and rhetoric, you know, when we're counting all of the items, you know, if you got, you know, going back to the car engine laid out on the driveway with all of the parts, you know, and you're counting the screws, well, you better be able to have number to count them with, right? And, you know, how did they design these parts? If you want to go further, then you're going to need to know the geometry and the algebra and everything else. It helps to know the metric system to find your bolts and whatnot. So all of these things can factor in, but if you just, you know, dismiss them or skip these steps entirely, you know, if you don't want to know how something is, then you're just left to jump to whatever conclusion. And then, you know, when the engine doesn't start, when you've put it together, you know, you go, ah, well, you know, well, the gods didn't want it to work. You know, basically, you have to appeal to magic, you know, and that's one of the most common things that I see is the fallacy. And I actually, I don't even think it's named, but it's the fallacy of appeal to magic. And it's, you know, when there's a car accident or something, you say, oh, well, it was an accident. Somebody will say, oh, well, it could have been, it could have been intended. Okay. Where's your evidence? You know, it's like they appeal to some magical force, right? Some hand came down and caused that accident. Never mind that, you know, one of the two drivers was, you know, clumsy or wasn't paying attention or fell asleep or drunk or whatever it may be. You know, never mind actually getting to the facts of the matter. We're just going to leap to the first magical unsupported conclusion that we come to. And then we're going to go, aha, I debunked you. You know, you're going to leap out like Superman in underoos and aha, you know.
that's an awesome visual that you painted. So when it comes to education itself, we know that, at least I know that, it seemed like education for me was more about molding me into something that would a functional cog in the machine that was already established. It didn't seem like I was, in my education, it didn't seem like I was being taught how to think, but more what to think. And
Nathan, you're educated to run the cash register at Target.
Exactly. And it always felt like, to me, it felt like there was something intrinsically wrong about education, well, or at least schooling. And then I come across the idea or the definition of schooling, which is basically like a school of fish, get everything to move in the same uniform direction as opposed to education. But when I came across your interviews with John Taylor Gatto and was introduced to the historical aspects and how the Prussian education system came into the American school system, and a whole bunch of answers just started being laid out for me. So if you can kind of explain to people what the historical buildup to our current public education system is.
Well, you know, and Kevin Cole is probably better at laying out a lot of this history than I am, as are others. But, you know, and I recommend people on the triviumeducation.com website, the first talk that's listed there at the top of the list is a talk with Kevin Cole where he goes into all of the history of this. But, you know, to give it in a nutshell, essentially in Prussia, they lost a war to Napoleon because the people were educated in the trivium and they refused to sit there and die for the king's cause, right? And so Napoleon came in and crushed the Prussian Empire. And so what they did was they created a new education system to totally dumb everybody down to make sure that all of the military would be order takers and follow orders without question to their death. And so this was the origin of the Prussian education system, and then it was imported by, I think, guys like John Dewey, et cetera, in the early 1910s, 1920s into the U.S. and basically brought in by force, and they had to get rid of the single-room schoolhouses, et cetera. Probably the single-room schoolhouse and the trivium together were the backbone of the American Revolution and what made the U.S. the most powerful nation on Earth and the fastest growing, because you know, what happens when you put a bunch of kids in a room together from first through eighth grade is that the older kids teach the younger kids learn from the older. And by the time, you know, the best way to learn something is to teach it. So by the time you're in eighth grade, you've taught everything. An 1890s eighth grade graduation test was more difficult than a bachelor's degree graduation today. And so what happened was you had a lot of 12 to 14 year olds in the 1800s that were fully capable of running large corporations and businesses and farms and things like this, whereas today kids are hardly competent to play video games and the like. And you know, when you step back and you say, well, how could a child be a king or run a large corporation? It was because they were taught the critical thinking and things like that. And you know, a couple of years ago, last year, we saw a news article out of Texas where, you know, some politician was bashing on the idea of teaching kids critical thinking, and obviously, you know, especially the logical fallacies, because then the kids would be able to see through the adults' BS and the adults' lies. And so, of course, these politicians don't want that. You know, you wouldn't actually want to empower, because, you know, the politicians say, well, you know, this might lead them to mistrust us, or, you know, this sort of thing. And it's like, well, of course, you're lying to them. You know, if you taught them critical thinking, of course they're going to see through your lies. But rather than empower the people and create real solutions, what they do is they appeal to the stink of their own farts, their own advercunium, and they, you know, their own justification and lies and whatever, and they decide that they have the right to decide these things for everyone else. And probably the key person in the last century behind this type of behavior and trying to push his sociopathic ideas on the rest of humanity was Aldous Huxley. I mean, that guy is the most sociopathic individual that I have ever come across in my life. You know, a lot of people think that he was actually out warning society and everything, but he and his brother Julian Huxley were actually the ones designing the ideas behind the New World Order, you know, the brave new world. You know, we got to be brave, folks. We got to be in and be brave. And when you get that the caste system in his book with the alphas, the betas, the epsilons, or deltas and epsilons, so that's taken right out of the Hindu caste system. And then he brings in the Hindu Soma and all of these ideas, and then he starts, he helps co-found the Esalen Institute with Michael Murphy and Dick Price up in Northern California, where they then start selling all of these very Eastern philosophical ideas into our culture through, you know, Aldous Huxley style. You know, and Aldous Huxley's brother ran UNESCO. He was the president of the British Eugenics Society. Their grandfather was actually Darwin's PR propaganda manager. He was known as Darwin's bulldog. And I mean, this whole family is just as sociopathic and, you know, just as twisted and mentally deranged as you could possibly get. And the irony is it's all based off of fallacious logic. And when you read about Huxley and these, you know, his family, they're considered these great intellectuals and all of this stuff. But, you know, his logic, in going back to your point earlier, are they taught this stuff? I mean, if he was taught it, you know, he really probably believed his own garbage, because he's just such a you know, he's just so absurd. And, you know, I should also point out that being a Fabian socialist, their logo is a wolf in sheep's clothing. And, you know, so he would always go out pretending that he was warning people, but he never tells you that he and his family were the key people behind orchestrating. It's always this mysterious other that he's warning you about. But, you know, I actually got the former commander general of U.S. Army intelligence on my show a month ago to admit that Aldous Huxley ran the CIA's MKUltra program.
That's crazy. And you mentioned, I'm going to segue into this. You mentioned Aldous Huxley and MKUltra, and I know that Aldous Huxley wrote a book called The Doors of Perception, and that's where the Doors actually admit that they got their name from. How much influence is this whole MK Ultra scenario? How much did it play through groups like the Doors into controlling the counterculture, the revolutionary spirit that started coming up in the 60s and 70s?
The quote unquote revolutionary spirit. Well, see, the revolutionary spirit was really already there. You had a lot of war protesters against the war, and then what the CIA did was dump massive amounts of drugs into the protest movements to corrupt them and to get people not to pay attention to them, because then you've got a bunch of drugged out hippies mixed in with them. And then what would happen is every time one of these big protests would go on, Timothy Leary, and we've got a recording of him admitting that he was an agent, but he would show up at these protests and say, you know, everybody, you need to tune in, turn on, drop out. You need to forget about the soldiers in Vietnam, you know, forget about politics. You got to forget about all that stuff, guys. You know, just go sit on a pillow in the grass and meditate. And, you know, and meanwhile, you know, your predators are going to have control over you. But as long as you're, you know, praying to Buddha or thinking that, you know, you're one with the guy in consciousness, and that, you know, this whole group think that you're going with, as long as you believe in that, we've got you, you know. So just keep going with that, and you know, no problem. Don't look over here, folks. So when you get that, you know, all of that whole thing is groupthink. I mean, you know, I really recommend people get into Dave McGowan's research on Laurel Canyon, and he did a mini episode series on Maria Heller's show. And I tried to get him on my show, and he had agreed to, and then he kind of disappeared. He's kind of, you know, I know he's been on Deanna Spingola's show a couple of times too, but track down everything you can of his and read his website and listen to all the audio you can find of his, because he really lays out how nearly all of the key rock stars of the 60s and early 70s were the sons and daughters of intelligence. You know, and I've known a bunch of rock bands in my life and things like this, and I've known none of them have gotten huge and famous, and there were two formerly famous musicians in those bands, though. You know, so it's like, you know, when you look at Laurel Canyon and the San Francisco scene, basically these bands showed up and they were famous. You know, like the drummer for the Byrds, he'd never played drums before. He just picked up a drum one day and he was a famous drummer. And so, you know, that's how it went with these guys. I mean, we've got Frank Zappa. His dad worked at Edgewood Arsenal. Jim Morrison's dad was Admiral Morrison, who started the Gulf of Tonkin incident to get us into the Vietnam War. Just go right on down the list, you know. So it's huge. And then in 1979, Jim Ladd, an L.A. area DJ, he put out this audio about the origins of FM radio back then, and I just found it in my audio archives a week or two ago, but he's explaining how they literally had to develop the FM or frequency modulation band to carry rock music, because they, you know, the AM radio wave, it's mono, it's, you know, you get the same audio out of both left and right speakers. So they needed something that could carry a different frequency in the left and right speakers, so that it would affect the left and right hemispheres of the brain differently. And so this was where FM radio was born. And, you know, so Jim Ladd lays all of this out, and you have to do a little bit of reading between the lines. But when you match it up with his work and of the Grateful Dead and what was happening out of Laurel Canyon, you look at Stanley Osley, who is one of the, you know, he was another agent man, and he was one of the key manufacturers of LSD. He was also the Grateful Dead sound man. And then he's sort of got overlap here and there in the development of FM radio and this sort of stuff. But, you know, rock and roll, essentially, there would have never really been FM radio without the rock music. And then when you look at how all of these rock bands, the Byrds, the Doors, Buffalo Springfield, Jimi Hendrix, just go on down the list, and you're like, wow, so many of these guys are sons and daughters of intelligence. Oh, Here's another good one, the band The Police. Stuart Copeland, his brother, Stuart Copeland is in the band. His brother, Ian Copeland, well, their father actually created the OSS and was a co-founder of the CIA. And Ian Copeland, his brother, aside from promoting their band, The Police, runs IRS records and FBI talent agency.
So what do you think about moving into nowadays from then, and we see all of these Illuminati symbolism in pop culture and pop music now, and we see things like Jay-Z having his clothing line filled with Masonic symbolism? Do you think that that these are just coincidences, or do you think that there still is that influence?
It's all, you know, it's all staged, and you know, there's a lot of elitist and Zionist and Masonic symbolism that overlays all of this stuff. I mean, they all love to get their little dibs of control in there, you know, rather than uplifting people truly. But all of the pop culture, I mean, if you read my article, Manufacturing the Deadhead, that I wrote with Joe Atwill, in there we talk about how Edward Bernays created the pop star, the rock idol. That was intentional PR. They needed to create essentially pop culture gods that the kids would follow along with. And so, you know, kids out there, teenagers, young adults, all of you people, read Dave McGowan's work, read our article on the Gnostic Media website, Manufacturing the Deadhead, a Product of Social Engineering. And even if you're not a deadhead, read it anyway, because it's showing you how they create these pop icons and how they essentially direct the culture to what they want. And so, you know, if you wake up, you can actually see it and you can pull yourself out of it. But it is a form of, you know, a basic form of mind control, and you should be in control of yourself. These others, you know, except by their own false appeal to authority, have no right over your sovereignty. And the only way that they get away with this stuff is by your consent. And so when you learn the logical fallacies, and when you learn how they do this stuff, and when you study this information and learn how to put your grammar before your logic, you can free yourself from these tricks, and then they no longer have any impact on you whatsoever.
Yeah, and I think that's probably one of the tide shifting things that has come out of a lot of your work and a lot of the stuff from Tragedy and Hope and other people, is the fact that you guys actually are empowering us with the ability to withdraw our consent and to wake up to these things that are going on. We're coming up on a break. Do you think that you have some time to stick around for the other side, or do you got to go?
My voice is wearing thin. I can go maybe till one more commercial break.
Okay, well, we've got a commercial break coming up in about 2 minutes, so...
I'll go through this one, and then one more after that is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay, sweet. When we come back, I'd like to kind of maybe touch on Disney. I know that Disney has a huge role in this. I don't know if I'll be springing something on you that you're not prepared to handle, but at least in the music industry, it seems like a lot of the weird stuff that goes on in the music industry comes directly out of Disney, and I know that Disney's...
Well, you know, I probably couldn't go that much into it. I mean, you're kind of hitting it. I mean, they direct more of their stuff with the younger children. I think Michael Jackson was probably ready to expose a lot of that stuff that was going on. And one of the reasons why he probably got whacked right there at the end, you know.
Yeah, but, and actually, Michael Jackson actually was coming out and starting to speak up against
this stuff. Oh, big time, big time.
Yeah.
And in fact, his sister LaToya went on television saying that he called her the night before he was died, saying that they were going to murder him. Somebody else came out recently with a recording that they say is an original, also saying that that also talks, you know, it's a recording of Michael Jackson saying he's going to be assassinated. He talks in another video, he starts getting into the New World Order, but he was actually going to start a world tour to expose all of the stuff that they had basically done to him and his family over the last 30, 40 years. And being the most popular, you know, pop star in the world, he also had the most power, and more, in fact, more power than any of the politicians. And right. So he had to be removed, you know.
Well, and if anybody wants to know or look at an indication of where Michael Jackson was going, go and check out the music video, They Don't Really Care About Us, and it pretty much...
Oh, you just let the cat out of the bag on that.
Right.
You know, There's that one, and you know, there's another one too. But yeah, that's definitely one of the two key songs. But his last album, he really starts getting into some of the core issues there, you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, when we come back, Jan, I'm very grateful that you're going to extend your time with us. We'll try and wrap up the interview and bring a close to all this stuff. This is Live Free FM. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on the other side of this break. You know, as an anarchist, I'm fundamentally opposed to the existence of all nations, save one, donations. If you find this show valuable, please consider making a donation by clicking the donate button at the bottom of each page on livefreefm.com. Your continued support keeps us on the air, keeps us on the web, and most importantly, keeps us commercial free. Live Free FM, brought to you in part by you. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to the show. This is Live Free FM. I'm your host, Nathan Frazier. And tonight we've been joined by Jan Irvin of Gnostic Media, GnosticMedia.com, and actually plenty of other websites. And we'll give Jan the chance to plug all of those websites before the interview is over. Jan, before we went into the break, we were talking about Michael Jackson and the music industry as a whole. And I kind of was, I guess, getting at the possibility that the music industry might still be being used as a weapon of mind control against them.
Might still be.
Yeah. Well, and I kind of wanted to get into, I guess, we were talking about the use of psychedelics as mind control, and I know that anybody who's done any kind of research on LSD has come across the connections between MK Ultra and LSD. They had the experiments where they were trying to see how soldiers would react under LSD or use LSD as a truth serum. And when we kind of look at what happened once they introduced LSD to the counterculture movement of the hippies and how that entire...
Well, they didn't introduce it to the counterculture movement. They created the counterculture movement. Vito Polak has created the hippie look and dress. I mean, he was an agent. They created all of that.
And what they did, though, is they effectively took something that was a threat to the mainstream established status quo, and they basically took it and ran it into the ground and made it completely ineffective at actually bringing about any kind of change.
And, of course, all of the hippies thought that they were empowered because, you know, essentially they got high and found God. Whether or not they actually did is irrelevant. They thought they did, but, you know, while they're sitting there pillow sitting and positive thinking, they're no longer taking action, which was the goal.
Yeah.
And, in fact, Oscar Janiger in the video, A Conversation on LSD, says that he's joking around and he's talking about all of the studies he's done at Harvard and everything that they've done there. And he says, you know, nobody at Harvard ever had the spiritual experience or any of that. And before I continue with the end of his quote, the CIA throughout the 50s, every agent was required to take LSD. Now, Going back to Oscar Janiger, now he says that the spiritual or religious experience with psychedelics doesn't happen until you cross the Colorado River. And then Timothy Leary, who admits that in that same talk that he was an agent, and as was Kesey and the others, he turns to Janiger and he says, "That's right." You know, because, you know, that was something that they PR'd or marketed, you see. And I've actually been working on a paper on this very subject. But early on, psychedelics were known as psychotomimetics, which meant, and this isn't to bash on indigenous cultures or anything like that, and there very, very well may be something there. The trivium and the quadrivium, you know, show something might be there that we can't yet understand, but it's not found in, you know, it's nothing that we see in any of the religions, etc. And so I'm not pretending to have all of the answers, but what we have to realize is that without the trivium, if you're taking psychedelics and you think you have critical thinking without studying the trivium, let me tell you, you are a prime subject to be mind controlled. A hippie, a Grateful Dead head type, a New Ager type, those are all three the easiest groups of people to mind control, hands down. And they think they're the most independent because they're deadheads or whatever. But once you get that whole thing, as you said, it was to drive them into the ground, to get them not motivated, to get them to be feminists and to not focus on, you know, building structured, strong families. Because obviously, if you're trying to build a world government and a new world order, you don't want people with with strong family backgrounds, because if the government or their financial situation falls apart, people just return to their families and their farms, and they go, I don't care about that stuff. But, you know, if you're a single mom who's, you know, all about, you know, men are evil and all of this nonsense that Karen Strahan of Girl Rights What is exposed, if you're all about that stuff and getting your check from the government, guess what? You're never going to retaliate against that government, no matter what they do, because you're getting your check from that government. That government is your spouse, you know, so you are married to that government. And this is all by, I think it's all by design. And I think it's, you know, easy to show. We've put out the brain database that has all of the information in there showing how these things tie together, especially under the Fourth World Wilderness Conference. And I had George Hunt on my show last year, I suppose it was, Say What Is Unsaid, UNCED, and he exposes all of this stuff as well. But all of these things tie together. We've got, you know, Terrence McKenna, he took his idea of 2012, for instance, from CIA agent Michael Coe, from his 1966 book on the Maya. He took another part of it from Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who is a Jesuit priest, and here he created the Omega Theory, and he was also often quoted by guys like Edmund de Rothschild for his ideas on how the New World Order should be implemented through spirituality and whatnot. But, you know, so Terrence McKenna takes these ideas from him and some eugenics ideas from Huxley and some from the CIA, et cetera, and he puts all of this stuff together and he creates this 2012 meme, and he goes around and he's selling it with, you know, with the mushrooms, et cetera. You know, so just last month or 2 months ago, somebody sent me a recording that it's from 1994 at the Esalen Institute. And like I said, the Esalen Institute, we have revealed over and over and over that this place is really CIA central for spreading these new age and psychedelic religions. This place is really their key center. And so in 1994, we have Terrence McKenna at a talk there saying that he is, quote, and let me just get this up here, saying that he says, when I reached La Torreira in 1971, I had a price on my head by the FBI. I was running out of money. I was at the end of my rope, and then they recruited me and said, you know, with a mouth like yours, there's a place for you in our organization. I've worked in deep background positions, about which the less said the better. And then about 15 years ago, they shifted me into public relations, and I've been there to the present. You know, and I remember years ago, when I first came forward with this information, you know, everybody was really upset. And, you know, I think even Chris Geo went out attacking me on the radio, having setting up an interview with Dennis McKenna trying to debunk me. But here we have Terrence McKenna admitting that he's a public relations agent, that he was busted and all of this stuff. So we see all of this stuff centering on the Esalen Institute and all centering on Aldous Huxley and this specific group. Now, again, I had General Stubblebine on my show a month ago admitting that Aldous Huxley was the key guy behind MKUltra now. As you brought up, Aldous Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception, that really launched the psychedelic movement, along with, shortly after that, Gordon Wasson's article, Seeking the Magic Mushroom, on May 13, 1957, in Life magazine, that was run by Henry Luce, who Wasson worked with at the Century Club with the CIA. So, I mean, we've laid all of this stuff out in the articles and everything, but now we have the actual documents in their own words and everything, admitting this, you know, this stuff that we've been trying to expose for so long.
So I guess I'll tie this back to the guilt by association fallacy. Now, when we're going through all this stuff and seeing how psychedelics have been used to manipulate the not so mainstream culture, when I first came across your work, it was actually years and years ago, and it was on a podcast by Richard Grove, and it was talking about the mushroom cult and the possibilities of the mushrooms being influenced on Gnosticism. And I know myself, I've tried quite a few different psychedelics, and actually the first time that I tried DMT was actually with Chris Geo, so I have to thank him for that. But I do understand, without the trivium, how they can be used to manipulate, but because they have been used to help manipulate, does that mean that these, you know, psychedelic mushrooms or LSD or DMT, does that mean that these things are automatically bad things?
Well, you know, it's like a steak knife. You know, you can use it to cut your food, or you can use it to stab somebody with it, right? Essentially, you know, here is my position on it, and I've studied in the field of ethnomycology for 20 years, or have written books on it, and I've gone from one side of the field to the other. I used to be very pro-psychedelics, and then sort of in the middle, and now I'm kind of on the other side looking at it going, you know, while there is still some benefit to them, there is so much danger. And so here's my caveat. I recommend nobody take them until they've had at least 2 years study of the trivium, because, you know, the peak experience on these substances is when the program is put into you. I mean, when we understand, for instance, going back to the military calling these things psychotomimetics, you know, so it was Aldous Huxley, and, you know, it was essentially the army was using the word psychotomimetics, and then Aldous Huxley didn't like that. He creates the word phanerothyme, and you know, it was really unmarketable. And so then a close buddy of his, Dr. Humphrey Osmond, who is also in MKUltra, he came up with the word psychedelic. Now, literally, I'm not kidding you, he and Humphrey Osmond hired Timothy Leary to promote psychedelics. They went to Harvard, they hired him to do this job. And Leary, again, he was CIA. They were all CIA. We don't have the exact sub-project number that specific project was. Like, we know that Gordon Wasson's Life magazine article and his launching Magic Mushrooms in the public through Life and through This Week magazine in May 1957, that was MKUltra sub-project 58. And we have the exact number. We have the exact documents that show that was that specific project. But anyway, so Leary goes out and he promotes, quote-unquote, psychedelics, a word that Humphrey Osmond created. And then, of course, we all hear the story of how, oh, Leary ruined the word psychedelic, and, you know, so now we needed a new word. And then in 1979, Gordon Wasson and Carl Ruck and Jeremy Bigwood and Jonathan Ott, they were just so good, and they just wanted to get together and create a new word for us. And thank goodness Wasson had his background in public relations at J.P. Morgan Bank and was personally trained by Edward Bernays, because if it wasn't for all of that, today we wouldn't have the word entheogen. And so, you know, what they did was they took the marketing a step further, because psychedelic essentially means manifesting the mind. And so entheogen means to generate God within. So they took it from psychotomimetic, meaning psychosis mimicking, to phanerothyme, to psychedelic, to now entheogen. Okay, and we can see how it was marketed, and Humphrey Osmond and Aldous Huxley were both PR guys and working with MKUltra. Gordon Wasson, who helps create the word entheogen. He was MKUltra subproject 58. All of these guys are CIA folks. They're marketing these ideas to us. That's why they think it's a big joke when they talk about the religious experience only happening when you cross the Colorado River. Now, why is it that the entire CIA tripped in the 1950s and they never became a bunch of hippies? Problem. And so, going back to my earlier work, when I was writing my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, we were writing on Christianity's use of mushrooms, and a common theme kept coming up, and we couldn't quite get at it at the time. But the issue was that, if psychedelics were so good, then why were these patriarchal religions like Judaism and Christianity using it? And, so it created a conflict, which made me think about it for years and years and years. And then when you stop thinking about it from your own bias that they're spiritual, and if you think about it from the predator's perspective, the shaman, the guy who peacocks, who puts on the big headdress and passes out all the drugs and performs the fancy ritual, just like the judge does or any of these other guys, well, he's assuming authority by performing these rituals, and then he gives you the drug. And again, whether or not the experience is real in large face and small face is irrelevant, But, the issue is that reality is real. We can trust our own five senses. Quantum physics is a total joke, and I recommend people listen to Peace Revolution episode 62, David Harriman, study all of his work, my two interviews with him, so that you get how they manipulate us. Because quantum physics, going back to this appeal to magic stuff, quantum physics, they want us to believe that you can fit 11 contradictions into one time and space at the same time. Can you imagine that's essentially a freeway pileup? And they want you to think that we can live and think coherently in a 11 car pileup. And so we need to see how the language and these tricks are used, how they get us to appeal to magic and false beliefs, and how Huxley and McKenna and these people that told you that you couldn't know truth, that you couldn't trust your own five senses, and those guys that, like McKenna, that told you that conspiracy is a epistemological cartoon of reality, well, they're lying to you. McKenna was a PR agent for either the FBI or the CIA. We haven't been able to determine which agency yet, but he's admitted it in his own words. The CIA blocked my FOIA requests, saying that a search would reveal an openly acknowledged agency affiliation. And that was their reply to, denying my request. So we know he's either at one of those two agencies. So why are people buying into this? And don't buy what they're selling. What they do is they tell you that the type of experience that you have, do mushrooms, 7 grams in silent darkness, and you're going to see God or whatever. And then you go do that, and then you're going to have, you're very suggestible in that heightened state. And the suggestions that they give you in those audio recordings and everything, they're going to impact you. If you do not have the trivium before you go into that experience, you will not be able to see through their tricks.
All right. Again, I have to thank you for coming on and bestowing all of this. I know that for yourself at least, you've kind of walked a long road, especially on this particular subject. You've had to come from one point of view, and through eliminating the inconsistencies, you've arrived at another point of view, and that's really hard for people to do. And I commend you for it, battling with that confirmation bias and cognitive dissonance. It's not something that everybody can do, and sometimes it's a quite scary process. So I would say that what you were able to do and the path that you've been able to take, I don't know if everybody is able to do that, but I do know that the tools that you've been putting out there have made it obviously that you've employed them yourself. I've employed them, and they've been great help to me. So I'd kind of like to wrap the conversation back around to that, and in the conversation on what you guys are doing, what you at Gnostic Media are doing, people like Brett Vinod at School Sucks, people like Richard Grove over at Tragedy and Hope. As far as what you guys are doing, it's almost like you've got this subgenre of alternative media, and it's a very empowering. It's taking these tools that have been occulted from us and laying them out there for people. What is it exactly that is the goal of the work that you guys have been collaborating on?
Well, it's just that. It's to empower people. It's to get people to put their grammar before their logic, to stop leaping to conclusions before they've looked at the information. And, you know, just because you studied a subject somewhere else, you know, don't assume that because you studied one or two scholars that you have all of the information. You always study every new argument, and you take in that specific information, and then you can go back through and verify it against previous information. You know, it's like if you're a Christian and you refuse to study secular scholars, you know, all you're doing is you're killing the messenger, and you're using ad hominem attacks to disinformation, which is lying. And so, and just like any other group or whatever, so we always use our five senses to look at the information first and study it. Then we remove the contradictions and the fallacies, and then what's left is the truth, and then we can explain that to other people. But, you know, without that, you know, people are left whacking at the branches. And so what all of us are trying to do, and we should probably mention James Corbett and the Corbett Report in there too, are really trying to empower people with real information that lifts them up, you know, give them the information about the paleo diet and how the whole low-fat diet is a total scam from hell, how the, you know, wheat is one of the biggest poisons you can put in your body. Nobody should ever eat wheat, W-H-E-A-T, the stuff you make bread with. Don't ever eat that stuff, folks. Take it out of your diet. But, you know, the low-fat, high-wheat scam and these sorts of things, these are what make people sick and not able to think clearly. And without a knowledge of the logical fallacies and the trivium and things like that, there's just no way for people to see through. So our goal is really to level the playing field and to empower everyone.
And where do you see, I know that for the longest time, this type of information just wasn't available. Things like discussions that you and me have had tonight, they really never happened. And if they did, it was in dark rooms by nefarious people behind closed doors. But
well,
now,
where else would a conspiracy conversation take place? Do you think they would like float down from parachutes or something? Or like,
no.
You know, I mean, it's so funny. Like people throw out, what do you think? They meet in secret boardrooms? It's like, yeah, of course. Where do you think they would have these conversations?
No, they have them in the park in full view of everybody.
Well, sure. And there too, you know, all over the place. Like where would you have a conversation, you know?
Yeah, but because of the rise in the alternative media, because of the rise in communication, sometimes we talk about on this show how leaps in communication have revolutionary effects on society. And I think that right now we're watching the very first waves or the ripple effect of this new communication.
Let me just say that if people can get at it through their thick skulls to stop name calling at people and dismissing information that you haven't yet read, then we'll get a long way. Use your brains and read something first before you judge it. You cannot know what something says. You cannot judge what something says, and you cannot offer a valid opinion about what something says until you have read it. So don't commit the most egregious crime of ignorance out there. Have brains and study something first. Get on the same page, know what it says, and then you can think and comment intelligently.
And for the longest time, we've been trained to interact in the exact opposite, but because of the work of people like Gino Denning and yourself and a lot of others out there, these tools for thought, these tools for communication are actually starting to make it out there. If it continues, if you guys are allowed to keep going, doing the things that you're doing, what's your eventual goal and what's your hopeful outcome before we let you go?
Oh, I don't know. My eventual outcome would just to see more would be to see more people empowered and being able to see through this. I mean, I don't offer all the solutions. You know, I don't tell people how, you know, or what they should think or what they should do. Our goal is just to get people to realize that they're whacking at the branches and then get down to the roots, and then we can all focus on our own problems and solutions, you know.
All right, absolutely.
Sort of a voluntarist method or approach, you know.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Jan, for coming on. GnosticMedia.com, and what are some other websites where people can check out your work?
All right, TriviumEducation.com. That's TriviumEducation.com. Also, PopUpFallacies.com is about to be re-released here. And I also run JohnAllegro.org. That is the famous Dead Sea Scrolls scholar that published the book, The Sacred Mushroom of the Cross, and I am the publisher of that book. And those are the main ones where we've got a, you know, for people who just want to check out the shows like this with guys like you, we've finally put SlavesAnonymous.com pointed at the page with Freeman Burt and your stuff and, you know, Mark Stevens, etc.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jan. It's been a pleasure, an awesome conversation. I hope the listeners got as much out of it as I did, and we'll keep in touch.
All right. Thank you, sir. So, have a good night.
You as well.
Thanks to your audience, too.
All right. Thank you, Jan. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our interview with Jan Irving. I apologize. I hope that you guys enjoyed that. Real quick, before we go, I want to give a huge thank you to everybody that donated this week. My aunt, actually, Ginny donated. Andy Ross made a donation to the show. James Robertson, Robert Mayers also made a donation. Shannon Moore made a donation. And Nicholas I don't know. I butcher your last name, and I apologize. But Rev Nick or Rev Fila in the chat room made a donation as well. So I did want to say thank you to everybody that that helped keep the show going, helps pay for the hosting, helps to pay to keep the show commercial free. I do appreciate that. If you appreciate the unprogramming that we bring you here on Live Free FM with guests like Jan Irvin and the other stuff that we do, please consider going over to Live Free FM and making a donation to the website to keep it going. And next week, I'm not sure what I'm going to do next week, but I've got some ideas in the back of my head milling around for another very powerful, thought-provoking show. And hopefully you'll tune in next week. We're here live every single week right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network from 10 o'clock to midnight on the East Coast, 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock on the West Coast. Hope to see you next week. This is Live Free FM. If you want to be free, you got to live free. And, of course, have faith in each other, not in authority. I will see you next week right here. Same bat time, same bat channel. Live Free FM. Peace.
FM.
Do you love Live Free FM? Do you love your friends and family? Well, why not introduce your friends and family to Live Free FM? You may be asking yourself, but how can I do this? It's simple.
You can share.
By simply clicking the share button, you can let everybody know that you're listening to Live Free FM. You can share it on Twitter. You can share it on Facebook. You can even share it on Google. It's the 21st century, and the internet has made sharing easy. Sharing is caring. Share Live Free FM with the people you care about today. Sharing. It's not just for pinko commies anymore.
So you want to get a degree? Why? Let me tell you what society will tell you. It increases your chances of getting a job, provides you with an opportunity to be successful. Your life will be a lot less stressful. Education is the key. Now let me tell you what your parents will tell you. Make me proud. Increases your chances of getting a job. Provides you with an opportunity to be successful. Your life will be a lot less stressful. Education is the key. Now let's look at the statistics. Steve Jobs, net worth, $7 billion. R.I.P. Richard Branson, net worth, $4.2 billion. Oprah Winfrey, net worth $2.7 billion. Mark Zuckerberg, Henry Ford, Steven Spielberg, Bill Gates. Now here comes the coup de grace. Looking at these individuals, what's your conclusion? Neither of them, in being successful, ever graduated from a higher learning institution. Now some of you will protest, like, you know, money's only the medium by which one measures worldly success. And some of you even have the nerve to say, I don't do it for the money. So what are you studying for? To work for a charity? Need more clarity? Let's look at the statistics. Jesus, Muhammad, peace be upon him, Socrates, Malcolm X, Mother Teresa, Spielberg, Shakespeare, Beethoven, Jesse Owens, Muhammad Ali, Sean Carter, Michael Jeffrey Jordan, Michael Joseph Jackson. Were either of these people unsuccessful or uneducated? All I'm saying is that if there was a family tree, hard work and education would be related, but school would probably be a distant cousin. As if education is the key, then school is the lock. Because it rarely ever develops your mind to the point where it can perceive red as green and continue to go when someone else says stop. Because as long as you follow the rules and pass the exams, you're cool. But are you aware that examiners have a checklist? And if your answer is something outside of the box, the automatic response is a cross. And then they claim that school expands your horizons and your visions. Well, tell that to Malcolm X, who dropped out of school and is well renowned for what he learned in a prison. Proverbs 17:16. It does a fool no good to spend money on an education. Why? Because he has no common sense. George Bush. Need I say more? Education is about inspiring one's mind, not just filling their head. And take this from me, because I'm an educated man myself, who only came to this realization after countless nights in the library, with a can of Red Bull keeping me awake till dawn and another can in the morn, falling asleep in between piles of books which probably equated to the same amount I had spent on my rent, memorize equations, facts and dates right down to the letter, half of which I'd never remember and half of which I'd forget straight after the exam and before the start of the next semester, asking anyone if they had notes for the last lecture. I often found myself running to class just so I could find a spot on which I could rest my head and fall asleep without making a scene. Ironic, because that's the only time I ever spent in university chasing my dreams. And then after nights with a dead mind, I'd then find myself in a queue of half-awake student zombies waiting to hand in an assignment. Maybe that's why they called it a deadline. And then after 3 years of mental suppression and frustration, my proud mother didn't even turn up to my graduation. Now, I'm not saying that school is evil and there's nothing to gain, but all I'm saying is understand your motives and reassess your aims. Because if you want a job working for someone else, then help yourself. But then that would be a contradiction, because you wouldn't really be helping yourself, you'd be helping somebody else. There's a saying which says, if you don't build your dream, someone else will hire you to help build theirs. Redefine how you view education. Understand its true meaning. Education is not just about regurgitating facts from a book on someone else's opinion on a subject to pass an exam. Look at it. Picasso was educated in creating art. Shakespeare was educated in the art of all that was written. Colonel Harlan Sanders was educated in the art of creating Kentucky Fried Chicken. I once saw David Beckham take a free kick. I watched as the side of his Adidas-sponsored boot hit the patent leather of the ball at an angle which caused it to travel towards the skies as though it was destined for the heavens. And then as it reached the peak of its momentum, as though it changed its mind, it switched directions. I watched as the goalkeeper froze, as though recited to himself the laws of physics, and as though his brain was negotiating with his eyes that it was indeed witnessing the spectacle of the leather swan that was swooping towards it, and then reacting. But only a fraction of a millisecond too late. and before the net of the goal embraced the FIFA-sponsored borders, there was the prodigal son returning home, and the country that I live in erupted into cheers. I looked at the play and thought, damn, looking at David Beckham, there's more than one way in this world to be an educated man.